This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
I've seen all good people turn their heads each day, so satisfied I'm on my way.
Take a straight and stronger course to the corner of your life. Make the white queen run so fast, she hasn't got time to make you a wife.
There are many words that can be used to describe singer-songwriter John Anderson. Cautious is not one of them. Born in England in 1944, he began singing on his brother's daily route as a milkman before falling in love with rock and roll. Adventurous, scrappy, and spiritual, he formed an instant bond with bassist Chris Squire in 1968, and after a short stint with another band, the two formed Yes. Like Anderson himself, their music was otherworldly, bucking convention in both structure and sound. Their songs were a dynamic mix of jazz and rock that could last for as long as 20 minutes, and their concerts sold out stadiums worldwide. By the 1980s, the band had produced more than 11 critically acclaimed albums. Their music ushered in what's known today as progressive rock, paving the way for bands like Radiohead. And the English native is still testing the boundaries of music just like he did as a kid.
You know, I started singing when I was at school in a choir, and I was told to shut up, Anderson, not so loud. And I kind of calmed down a bit because I used to love shouting and singing, you know, choir, you know, they do that. And then me and my brother Tony, we used to sing all the Everly Brothers songs, and I was the high harmony. And I just loved singing. And then we started a band called The Warriors in 63, and in April 63, my brother had a motorbike, and he drove us, me and him, went to Southport, which is just north of Liverpool, to see this band called The Beatles, and they just released Love Me Do, 63 April. And from then on, I want to be Paul McCartney, of course. And you start singing and in a band, and basically, when you start off with a band, you have to sing all different kind of songs, from Joe Tex to Nina Simone songs.
Covers.
Covers, you know. And your voice, you're singing it. I actually remember I used to sing Goldfinger. It was a big hit in England by Shirley Bassey. It was
sure.
From Wales. And the review was, we found the Shirley Bassey of rock and roll.
That's going to be our tweet.
Freak me out.
Listen to my interview with the Shirley Bassey of rock and roll.
And I just kept singing and enjoying singing and went through the 60s with the band and then went to London, eventually meeting up with Chris. And I knew that I could sing, and I was very interested in songwriting. I'd never written any songs. I'd maybe written one or two terrible songs. But with Chris, I could sort of sit there and just work ideas out with him. And singing with Yes when it first started, I didn't move. I was very still on stage and stoned.
Right.
Know, of course. And just happy doing it. Didn't realize until I recorded that I had such a bad voice.
Well, why do you say that?
Well, you start listening to yourself for the first time through the speakers and everything.
When you're recording, everything
yeah,
changes.
Yeah, recording the first album, you know, and I think, oh my gosh, it's sort of pretty boring.
But that's interesting for people who don't know that when you're doing club work and you're performing live.
What do you think you're happening?
Yeah, everybody's
so
jumping
noise.
Up and down, but they're all drunk, so what do they know?
I mean, yeah.
You sound great.
Yeah.
Then. And then you get into a studio and things change. And what I'm also curious about is when you're singing covers and your very signature voice, which pitches high, is singing these other songs, where does that music come from, which is so unique?
You know, we weren't from the same town, the band itself. It was from different towns in England. Normally, like the Hollies, the Beatles, all the bands, the Animals, they came from Newcastle. The Hollies were from Manchester. The Beatles from Liverpool. Everybody, little tight group of friends, you know. Well, we weren't. We were in London, and Bill Bruford was from Sevenoaks down the road. He left the band after a month because he wanted to go. His parents said he had to be a lawyer. So we've been rehearsing as a band for a month, and Bill said, I'm leaving. I said, wait a minute, we've just started. So the strange story was that Bill went to Leeds University, and 2 months later, we played there. And he stood in the audience looking, sort of eyes at the band, thinking, this is really a great band. What am I doing here at university? And within 2 weeks, he was back in the band. But the idea is that, you start, when I met Chris, it was like, I've got to learn about writing songs. So I started playing the guitar.
You had not been writing songs.
No, no.
You didn't know how to read music?
No, no. The great thing was, because both Tony Kaye in the early days, they were very interested in what I had to say. And so I just had, all these ideas, musical ideas. I'd say, okay, somebody, I think it was Peter Banks, he was playing da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da on his guitar, just messing around, I said, that's it, we're going to do America. So we did a version of America that day.
From West Side Story.
West Side Story.
Bernstein.
Can't beat it.
Right.
Very
popular back
then.
Yeah,
and you take it on stage and it gets the audience going, So in those early days, it was like, well, what should we do next, John? Well, I've got this idea. I really like Stravinsky, sort of thing, And I'd start coming up with ideas on the guitar that, Peter Banks would say, you can't play that chord. And I say, well, I just did, and it sounds pretty good. Whatever,
So you, as a non-guitar player, were willing to take risks that the studied guitar players were saying to you, you can't do that.
Yeah, because, it's just one of those things. You do it, and then you start realizing, you go home and start trying other ideas.
How long did it take you to learn to teach yourself the guitar?
I'm still learning. It's true. It's just an ongoing, and I don't know what I'm playing. I'm playing chords the other day. I'm going, oh, this is a beautiful chord. I wish I knew what it was, but it sounds really good.
I wish I could remember that.
I do. I tape everything and re-remember. In fact, you start doing music that you wrote maybe 5-10 years ago. You find a cassette and go, oh, yeah, I never finished that. I'll try that now, Maybe I wasn't ready then. Now I am, And so in a leap, we got Steve Howe in the band, which was like, oh, man, it was amazing because this guy could play classical music on guitar, as well as
Stravinsky.
Great rock and roll, And we started writing songs together. And
how did that work?
Well, generally, I'd listen to what they were doing in rehearsal, making a lot of noise.
In a studio, where you're recording everything.
Yeah, and I'd hear Steve playing something, and I'd quickly record it, and then we'd stop, and I said, listen, you played this line. What is that? And he said, I don't know. I was just jamming. I said, no, can you play it again? And he, okay, and then we're going to the, and then we keep going there, bring it up again, and a new key, modulate,
Yeah.
So my position in the band was waving my hands around a lot and hoping they would understand what was happening.
You're conducting.
Yeah. And then, as time moved along, Rick Wakeman came into the band, and it was like, so incredible.
Who was the most accomplished musically in terms of reading music, writing music?
Rick
was the one who wrote music.
Ridiculous. And the neat thing was that you were saying why the music came is because Bill Bruford was a jazz player, jazz rock. And him and Chris together, those early tapes, those early recordings are just fantastic, the BBC recordings. And you hear him and Chris rocking away, but it's slightly different than just pies. There's something going on with his shoulders, Bill. He's going round, And so when we sort of put together a song, I'd feel like, I think there's something else to happen. Maybe Bill and Chris just do a groove thing, and then we'll... Steve, if you can do, get your slide guitar out.
What's the first song you record?
Probably Yesterday and Today. I heard it the other day. It's terrible.
Is it really?
Well, it's, the album didn't do well. Second album just about didn't do well either. And the third album, we all went to, I wanted to get away from London. So I said, why don't we get a farm down in Devon, So we rented a farm in Devon, a farmhouse, and got all the equipment there and stayed there for a month, 6 weeks. And that's when, Yours Is No Disgrace came, and eventually Fragile. But it was like, it's very important to sort of isolate ourselves away from the getting to rehearsals in a big city can take forever, you know. So living together and being together sort of created a harmony. And one of the things I've learned is that with harmony, and you know this in acting, if you have perfect harmony, anything can happen.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
If you can get there, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
It feels so good, too.
Yeah. And it's rare. It's not something that happens all the time. Here's like a clue to why I think Yes worked in so many ways. It's that up until then, the bands would go on stage, sing a song, the solo, guitar player would solo, and then and the chorus again, and then a solo, and boom, finished. And I just didn't like that because you never know how good you're going to be as a solo guitar player if you've had too many drinks. You know, so you're great one night. And then the next night, what the hell was he thinking? You know?
Yeah.
So I said to Steve, especially Steve, he was very willing to understand that if you create a solo in rehearsal, record it, learn it, then your solo will always be the same. And then you can bounce and dance around it. And the same with everybody who played in the band. You know, I'd say, let's get it, so I called it structuring. Structure the music. Make sure you know exactly what you're going to play. And the interesting thing is Chris, bless him, was the main guy who stuck to that. He was a beautiful bass player. Listen to his bass work. Incredible. And generally, when you learn the art of the structure, you take that on stage and it can be 11 minutes long, 10 minutes long. You can stretch it a couple of minutes, but take for granted what you've already created and know that it worked.
Stick with it.
Yeah.
But you listen to your music. I mean, I close my eyes and then I roll your music in my head and it's so complicated compared to everything else that was coming. I mean, there was the Beatles deep in their work.
Oh, true.
And you listen to your music, you talk about Yours Is No Disgrace and it's like all those fractures and all that dun 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 boing 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 dun 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 dun. And this is so dramatic.
Oh, yeah.
It's these surges. It's like water splashing against a seawall. It's so violent sometimes. Whose concept was this of music? Who said, this is what we're going to do?
What were you smoking?
I was smoking a lot of stuff, man, you know?
No, I agree in some ways. It's like you create this music and you go on stage and perform it and it takes over. It's as though we've created something that's a little bit unique and we've got to make sure it's good. I remember first time we performed Close to the Edge, it seemed like about an hour. It's only 18 minutes.
Exactly. I was going to say, it's like about 18 minutes.
Because the audience was so quiet. What's going on? What's going on?
Yeah.
And it was at a gig with, you know, Elton John was top of the bill, My Vision Orchestra and us, and we did Close to the Edge. It was like, you could hear the crickets.
Really?
Saying, enough already.
But when you do that, is it hard to replicate it?
No.
You go out there, or it wasn't hard to replicate
No, because you know what you've got to do. It took a month for it to kick in. So by the time we came to tour America with Close to the Edge as a song, we'd already played it 20 times.
But did you need sheet music on stage to play it?
No.
How did the band remember 18 minutes of all those changes?
I don't know.
They were just into it.
Well, I think, you know, musicians in the last, you know, 50 years have concentrated on this new exercise of a brain sort of module. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm always amazed. You know, Trevor Raymond, our guitar player, he can do scores and he can hear all the music just like Amadeus. You know, like it freaks me out because I'd love to be.
He's
able
a
to
savant
do
that way.
Oh yeah.
When you would perform live, was there a process you had about your voice? Was there some kind of technique you had in terms of you didn't smoke and you didn't eat certain kinds of food?
You know, we went vegetarian very early on, and we, you know, before there were any vegetarian restaurants in America.
Right.
So we'd find one in New York, maybe, and one in Boston, and one in Seattle, or something like that.
Right.
And we kind of restricted ourselves from doing the norm, which is just, you know, going for the burgers and stuff. I used to on stage and say, you should all stop eating McDonald's.
Right. So for you, what you didn't feel, because your voice is so, I mean, it really sounds like an instrument. I'm not just saying this.
Yeah.
There was no special thing you had to do.
No.
You just blew it out and it was there
in
your pocket every time you needed it.
I just felt very blessed that I could sing. And I was actually going through this incredible journey. You know, it was like not many people get the chance to be successful in their work, you know.
What's your first big date?
We all lived in this little house. We all had a different floor of the house. Peter Banks lived in Barnet, which is North London. I got a phone call from a friend. He said, can you do a show tonight at Speakeasy? Most famous club in town, yeah. Yeah, what time are we going to be there? 10 o'clock. Why? Because you got to be there, man. Okay. So I called Peter. Come on, we've got to go and do a gig. Get everything to get the drums together. Get in the van. Come on, let's go. So we went to the Speakeasy and we started setting up. And then we found out the reason we were there is because Sly and the Family Stone had got stopped in New Jersey. And he couldn't get on the plane. Whatever, for whatever reason,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And I was working at that time in a bar above the Marquee Club, a very famous club in London. So I kept bumping into Keith Emerson because he was playing in Nice, and I actually bumped into two or three other Pete Townsend and that kind of thing. I never said hello. So there we were setting up microphones, and they start walking in, you know. There's Keith. Hi, Keith. Oh, John, what are you doing? I said, we're doing a show. What does it look like? You know. Well, what's happened to Sly? He says, here. And I started passing a joint around. I said, you have a smoke? I said, calm down. So by the time we went on, everybody was happily drunk and stoned or whatever. And I think Paul McCartney was there. I'm not sure. But there's a lot of very famous people there. And we put on the show of our life, you know.
Yeah.
We'd only been together for 2 months.
They came expecting Sly and you came out.
Yeah.
And you won them over.
We did it. Come on, guys. What rock and roll, you know. Twist and shout.
And you came off the stage and?
Yeah. Well, the manager of the club said, I want to manage you. And within a month, he got us a gig opening for the Queen Farewell Concert. So we opened it. And Rory Gallagher at the Albert Hall. So Rory Gallagher was on second and the Queen came on at the end. It was like, oh, God. You know, that, the funny thing, that going back to Bill Bruford was in Leeds University and we found out we were going to play this gig at the Albert Hall. So I said, Bill, you want to rejoin the band? He said, yeah. Well, in 2 weeks we're playing at the Albert Hall. Be there. And he was. Life is like strange, isn't it?
And then when the recording contract was with who? You signed
with
who?
Oh, that was silly. Arm Ertigan, God bless him.
And he found you where?
In London. He came to see us. We did a lunchtime, half an hour for him.
Oh, he had you almost like audition for
audition,
him.
That's right.
And what year was this?
68.
Right.
Early 69, maybe. Our manager at that time was the Speakeasy manager. Sweetest guy in the world, but he just, you know, he enjoyed a drink. And he was drunk. And it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you know. And so we did our little sort of audition, and I thought, I've got to go to the toilet. So I went to the toilet, and Roy comes in, stands next to me, we're having a pee, you know, and he says, I'm going to get this bastard, this American bastard. I'm going to make sure you got the best contract ever, ever in the world. And at that moment, the toilet flushed.
And he's in the other stall. Did he get you the best contract from this American bastard?
He signed us up for for 10 years.
For 10 years.
Like 2 points, you know.
Oh, God.
Armit was very cool because, you know, the second album didn't do too well. The third album was the Yes album, was okay.
It was Fragile.
And then fourth album was Fragile.
But when you signed with Ertigan, you had not been recording for anybody else.
No.
This was the beginning of your recording contract. So you do album number one, meh. You do album number two, meh. Number three, maybe. And then four hits.
Well, the thing was, Roundabout was 8 minutes long. It was a stage song, you know, the idea. I think one of the things I've always been interested in is putting on a show. Probably comes from my dad, because he was a showman in the army at the time.
What did he do?
All I can remember, I was in a stroller, and he was on stage in a kilt. He's Scottish. He was on stage in a kilt and a Hitler mustache.
No.
Telling jokes. And I think he played the harmonica.
He was a Scottish Nazi harmonica player. Man, I'm sorry I missed
kind of
that.
Wrong there.
Were you close with him?
Yeah, sort of. He got very ill very early on in his life.
He died when he was how old?
54.
And you were how old?
You got me there at 24.
My dad died when I was 26. Yeah. My dad died young. He was 55 too.
I was able to see him at the end to give him a good hug and say thanks.
Are either of your siblings musical?
Oh, gosh, yeah. My brother Tony, because we started off as the Everly Brothers of Accrington.
So he's a performer?
No, he's a preacher, actually, and he sings...
So he's a performer?
God songs, yes, of course he is.
I'm curious about, for people who, you know, don't completely understand this like myself, You do an album, Erdogan signs you, and the first album doesn't work, and the second album doesn't work, and the third album. Maybe they're all growing, and he sees something, because how do you get to do the 8-minute roundabout is on Fragile,
right,
the fourth
yeah.
album. So when you say to Erdogan, we're going to do an 8-minute piece, does
right.
he sit you down and go, fellas,
no, he
said you somebody, haven't earned the right to do an 8-minute
no,
piece?
No, he sent somebody in, I remember very vividly. It was, gosh, I can't remember his name, a very famous producer came to London, and we're doing... And the guy's there, sitting there and saying, why don't you put a funky bass in there? I said, no, it's supposed to go. And that's what it is. It's your move, actually, it was.
Yeah, of course.
Your move. And he said, boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
No.
Smash some, why don't you smash your guitar on stage at the beginning of that one? Yeah.
No, we just didn't do it. We just said, I said, I'm sorry, I like you very much, but I don't want it to be that way.
Is Roundabout the first hit?
Yeah, because somebody got some scissors out and didn't tell us. I know.
Was that in your contract that they could do that?
Of course.
They could.
They had our firstborn.
Right. So they cut Roundabout. From what to what?
Well, they just took out the whole middle section. So it goes from the end of the third verse or third chorus, second chorus, whatever, straight into the solo. And we were driving around Pittsburgh to a gig, and it would turn on the radio, and it's Roundabout. We said, Roundabout's on the radio. We couldn't believe it. And then it went straight into the solo.
Yeah.
We went,
what the hell? We'll charge the view. I mean, I know I'm kind of getting carried away here with you because I'm so excited. I'm actually talking to you. But, you know, Yes Songs is really one of the greatest live albums ever. I mean, if you're a Yes fan
right. And
you dig that music, you guys just crushed it. You know, did you know that when you recorded
Not
that?
Not really. No, I just knew we were sort of getting into the pocket. When I learned later, the pocket is when it just happens and music takes over. And that was one of those shows. I think we did about four in a row and we recorded one of them. And I don't know. Going back to George Martin, you know, I'd listen to what he did with four tracks and wonder why we're not as something. When you hear us playing live, what's wrong? I've always been like that. I'm terrible.
Critical, very self-critical.
Yeah. In a good
way. Did you drive the other band members crazy with your self-criticism?
Yeah.
Right.
They called me Napoleon.
They did?
Yes, on the quiet.
Do you agree that a band needs an external source of management in order to really function, or did you kind of function as a manager of your own
band?
Well,
we stopped using a producer after the third album. So we were producing ourselves with a very good engineer called Eddie Offord, who was brilliant.
How did that work for you with self-producing?
Brilliant.
You think so?
There's a great photograph of everybody on the levers.
You've even got their own set.
Yes.
I think we should do this.
Yeah. And it's just the idea of trusting. You know, trust is everything in music. You got to trust everybody to want the same thing, even though we're not quite sure what it is yet.
But did you feel you were in charge?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't. I used to say to Chris, because Chris always was to look at me and say, I just want to make you happy, John. I said, yeah, I'm not trying to boss everybody around. I just want to make it work.
Right.
And somebody's got to come up. If you come up
someone
with
ideas. Someone has to decide.
Yeah, if you come up with ideas, I'll follow it through. But it tends to happen. Somebody tends to be more of an idea person.
Right.
And I was into that, you know, like with reading Hermann Hesse and thinking, I really want to do something a little bit more experimental and long form. Steve, come here, man. Can you play some chords like this? And he's playing them. And I said, okay. And he'd say, I've got this thing. It goes close to the edge, round by the corner. And I'd sing, down at the end, round by the river, modulate, seasons will pass you by. I'm going to go, I get a chords, chords. I need some chords there, you know, and Steve will
to
be...
To hear you talk it through, you know. And then when you listen to the music, it's like something in a church.
Yeah, true. And, it's just, you know, it's like subconsciously, I'd be chords, and he'd play perfect chords. And I said, that's it, record it. Next part.
Did you interact with Wakeman the same way? Did he go with
while.
You?
It took a while with Rick, because Rick was very fast at just coming up with stuff. I didn't really Now and again, I'd hear something as, Rick, you just played something. I need that, please. I need to, what is this one? Oh, yeah, I need that. Whatever it was. And, you know, you go through these emotions in a studio of really listening to everybody, making sure that they are in a good place to perform well. You know, it's part of the routine of being buddies, musical brothers, if you like, you know.
I see the coldness in the night, and watch the hills roll out of sight. I learn in every single day, inside.
Coming up, John Anderson explains why Paul McCartney was his inspiration for taking drugs. While Yes was rocking the UK, the self-described cussing Christian behind Grand Funk Railroad was lighting up America.
The word from the Atlanta Pop Festival, you know, we opened noon the first day. They liked us so well, they moved us to 7 o'clock the second day. And then the third day, we were on at 11 o'clock under the lights.
They're the people that they're waiting for now. Yeah. To hear more about Mark Farner's story, go to heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Nicknamed Napoleon, English singer-songwriter John Anderson constantly pushed his bandmates to experiment further. Considering that Yes sold more than 50 million albums in his time with them, it worked. But although Anderson's adventurous spirit played a role in propelling them forward, there were other factors too, namely competition.
We did Close to the Edge. And if there was ever a rival band that I kind of watched and listened to was a band called King Crimson.
Really?
Because I'd heard about them. And me and Chris went to see them at the Speakeasy. This is like 1970, I think, maybe late 69. And they performed their whole first album. And it was just so incredibly good. They performed it, vocals. It was in the court of the Crimson King. And I looked at Chris and said, we got to practice more, guys. It's terrible.
You're very competitive.
I went,
So we did. You imploded.
I know. Then we went to Close to the Edge, and I thought we'd open this door, musically speaking. We'd found this ism. It's a yes-ism. It's something that every note is known to the band. Yeah. We know every ink.
You're there. You're there.
And to perform it was going to be amazing. And then Bill said, I'm leaving the band about 2 weeks after we finished it.
Close to the Edge.
Yeah.
Now, why?
He wanted to join King Crimson.
Really?
And he did.
Really?
And it broke my heart.
And what was that like for you?
Well, I thought we'd
finish. You guys are at the crest of the wave.
We'd just done this piece of music that meant we are now free to do and create what we want.
We're just as good as King Crimson.
Oh, yeah.
But when you feel you're just as good as King Crimson, you're different. Is that what he wanted was different?
Oh, yeah. He just said, making the album was great, John, but I'm just not comfortable with Chris wanting this and me wanting that. And I used to say, I always think the beat starts with the bass drum, bass, and everything evolves from there. Chris would say, no, the bass is the beat. So there's that argument going on with Bill. And basically, he went to Crimson, and I actually saw their first gig. It was a band that changed the name to Discipline. It was an album called Discipline with King Crimson. And it was remarkable to watch because you had Bill Bruford on stage with a little kit right at the front of the stage. Guitar player, I forgot his name for now, keyboard player, another guitar player. And this guy called Jamie Muir, who was like a percussionist. And he looked like a wild man from Borneo. He had long black hair and he had this sort of black woolly shoulder thing. It made him look like a very skinny ape. And what he would do, which was kind of interesting, he had sort of gongs in his hand and he'd bang them on the floor near microphones. So he had this band. And this guy was jumping up against pieces of metal, large-scale pieces of metal, to make the microphones on there. So there's incredible cacophony of energy going around the band, which is very tight, right? And I couldn't believe him. And I went to Bill Bruford's wedding, and there was Jamie Muir. And I said, Jamie, what are you doing?
Yeah.
And he said, wait there. And he went off, and he came back with a book. And it was the autobiography of a yogi by Yogananda. And he just gave it to me. He didn't say anything else. And that changed my life.
How so?
It's a very clear understanding that all religions are the same and all rivers go to the same ocean and divine energy is all around us all the time.
This is after?
Close to the Edge.
Close to the Edge.
We finished Close to the Edge. And Close to the Edge was, like, to me, a very concept album in itself, and You and I.
You finish Close to the Edge, Bruford leaves, you go to his wedding, you meet Jamie, he gives you the autobiography of a yogi. And who replaced Bruford immediately at that time?
Alan White.
So the next album after Close to the Edge is?
Then we went into Topographic World of Craziness, you know. Because
why do you say that?
Because, well, it's such a, you know, what's the word? It's such an incredible moment in my life anyway.
Why?
Well, because, you know, some joker in a newspaper said, Close to the Edge, the next thing they're going to do is the Bible to music. And I thought, yeah.
That's not a bad idea.
Not a bad idea.
Yeah, let's do that. And,
so I got the book and I was on a trip to Japan with the band, with Alan and everything, and Steve. And I read in the bottom of the book these four energies that create almost everything: is the revealing of everything, the remembering of everything, the ancient, and the ritual of life. You know, and I thought, that's it, with the four movements. You know, so I sort of jumped on Steve, who was perfect for it. You know, and
why?
Well, because he's very receptive, and
ready to go with you.
Yeah, very quick to
learn.
Did he
read the book?
Do you know, I don't know.
Did you give all of them the book and say, this is required reading before you start the album?
I just knew that if you're going to go anywhere, why don't you just jump in the deep end, you know?
So when you get head toward Tales, when you go to, as you were saying, this topographic madness, how are they changing, the other ones in the band? Do you sense, are they all on this journey and kind of getting into it with you and getting high with you? Or are some of them sitting there looking at their watch going, how much more of this revealing science of God? And wait a second, is this cat really going to do the Bible next? Where are we going with this guy? Was it all kind of cool?
Well, most of the time, me, Steve, and Alan, and then Chris on a level were very there. Rick was finding his own sort of pathway. He'd started writing some music about King Arthur or Henry VIII and stuff. And that was sort of, you could sense when he came in, he was thinking of other stuff.
Yeah,
you know? So it was like, lovely guy, but still a young guy. He was still young. He was very young when he joined the band. And so I was sort of headlong into this thing. Nobody can dissuade me at all. We're going there. And that's all there is to it. It's going to be great.
What is it about you that makes you so driven that way? I mean, you have an almost Ahab-like quest to synthesize what you're thinking, feeling, dreaming, believing into the music you're doing, regardless of the cost.
Right.
Do you know why? You're so self-examining, I would think. Why?
Yeah, I'm just so grateful, I suppose.
You just enjoy the journey?
Yeah, I'm so thankful. There was a certain point in time when I was very lost on heavy drugs and stuff in the early, middle
have you
of the talk, 60s.
Have you talked about that publicly?
I don't remember.
Did you do that because it was for free and for fun and silly and funny, and then it got to be, it makes you sick, kind of? And then how do you see it now in perspective?
What's that?
Your drug experience was
great.
What?
Well,
an unabashed endorsement.
No, hey, Daily Mirror, front page. Paul McCartney took acid. I said, "That's it. I can do it."
There you go.
That was my key.
Yeah, he's the blame.
He did it.
So he led you down that path.
Yes.
The guy that sings "Love Me Do."
Yeah.
Let's do that.
My God. All you need is love.
All you,
know,
you
Krishna.
Need is love.
My God.
So Tales comes out.
Yeah.
No. Fragile is a hit.
Yeah.
And Close to the Edge is
big
a hit.
Yeah.
And you guys are really rolling and
yeah.
steaming. And what is the tour situation like now? Your big stadiums, big places.
Fairly.
And you
no.
guys can fill a big
no,
room.
No, not, you know, I think we did 3 nights at Madison Square and, you know.
Did you enjoy them?
Yeah. It was like a very dream sequence, sort of looking back. You just remember it as being, wow, oh, I've got to get on stage. I got to know what I'm doing. Don't worry about it. Look for the furthest people away and wave to them because you don't want to just play to the 20 people in the front row. You got to play.
Sound like Mark Farner.
Yeah, you got to play. You got to play to everybody. You know, you got to.
Mark Farner told us he tore his clothes off because he wanted the people in the back row to pay attention to him.
Oh.
So he ripped all his clothes off.
Oh my God.
Down to it was like a little Speedo,
oh,
you know.
No.
From Grand Funk Railroad, yeah. But when you also are doing this, and regardless of the size, but I'm assuming particularly where there's the size and the amount of money available to to the promoters, does the stage tableau change? What's happening on stage? Lighting
same,
and graphics.
Same. We were lucky, you see.
Because your music lends itself to something spectacular.
Yeah. It's an interesting story that the first roadie we had was Mike Tate. And Mike Tate is now Tate Towers, one of the biggest touring companies in America, for sure. And we were doing a show up in north of England in a small pub, and he was driving us. And obviously a stripper would come on most nights in the pub. But we were doing our show, and there's all these little sort of switches on the side of the wall. And he was up and down with all colors on us like that, with little mm-hmm. switches like that. And I thought, oh, that's really cool. So we drove down to London, and Mike said, I'm going back to Australia. I said, no, you can't do that. You're going to be our lighting guy. I said, what do you mean? I said, what do you need? Because I just saw you
he
tonight.
He didn't know it yet.
No. So we got some money, and he made these genie towers, which came out of a box. We wound them up, and these
sure.
were car
you
lights.
Cranked them.
Car lights.
Wow.
And he had a little thing going. And
but you didn't have any screens and images?
No,
and
that came topographic time. We started projection. We were first band
what,
to use
what the,
laser.
What, and what did the band, what did the other bandmates feel about you bringing that
they
element onto the
they
stage?
They didn't really talk to me about so much about it. It was just, I think Roger Dean had done the artwork. Him and his brother started doing the staging. And the best staging that they did for us was the Relayer tour, Gates of Delirium, with a three-headed sort of thingy. It's incredible.
How did you meet Roger Dean? Tell people, how did you meet him?
I don't know. I think it was Steve said, oh,
he was
no,
in
no.
the other stall next
no,
to
no.
Ahmed Erdogan.
No,
he
right,
came out of the
no,
stall
no,
and flushed
no.
the toilet.
Yes, right. No, I'd seen this album cover of a band called Ossi Bisa in London. And it was just fantastic. And I looked at Roger Dean. And Steve said, I think I know somebody who knows him. I said, well, get him to come over. You know, Fragile, we were working on Fragile. And I just said, Roger, how are you? We all met and everything. Just put, you know, make something very fragile on the album cover.
Right.
So he came back with this little world. And I said, that's perfect. You know, and from then on, you know, we just kept working with him. So he would be involved in staging. Mike Tate was the lighting guy. And that was the way we worked in the 70s.
No, explain to me, because I don't understand this either. I really don't. And I'm always fascinated by this. When you're exploring your music, it's so dynamic and it's so spiritual and rock at the same time. It's everything. Mm. It's jazz. Mm. I mean, it's its own planet, if
right.
you will. I mean, I really believe that.
Right.
But at any point, do you feel that the vocals need, does it ever cross your mind? Like, we got to get a girl in here. Is there ever a discussion of a woman joining the band? Or does that never come
no,
up? Do we
no.
need a feminine voice?
No.
Never. The music is always put through the prism of John's the singer.
Yeah.
Got it.
And you get into that zone of, well, I'm writing the lyrics as well. Because I like writing lyrics. And
you do.
And me and Steve would write lyrics with each other. And me and Chris would write lyrics with each other. But I just tend to write a lot and think a lot and drive a lot. And I come on up the mountain, people. Come on.
Yeah.
We got to do this. Because who else is going to help us? Who else is going to help? Nobody else is going to help us. Because we're going this way. And we went on that journey. And it went right through the 70s to that point where it couldn't go any further. Because the House of Cards fell down.
We're going to talk about that in a minute. But yeah. when Topographic comes out,
yeah, it was.
How does that do?
Well, it's well documented that it was heavily criticized and very confused atmosphere around it because Rick hated it. He hated that it was too much for him because he was already half into something else, I think.
He wanted to be somewhere else.
I think so, yeah.
And eventually, when he said he hated it, he was on the record at the time or while you were making it?
Yeah, he said it's too much. It's too much music for people. It's too much music for them. And of course, I was...
What did he mean by too much music?
It was like you're trying to make people eat a whole cake at once.
Right.
You should put it in pieces.
Right. The pieces were too long.
It was
the structure of the album was not right.
It was 4 20-minute pieces. Because that's all you could fit on an album.
Right. That's all you could fit on an album.
Because if it was...
I could just see you. I could see you waking. I have this image of you waking up in bed and you pick up the phone and you're like, how many minutes fit on an album again? Is it 80? Great. I've got 4 20-minute verse songs, pieces. The revealing, the remembering.
Ritual, ancient. And you just think, There's got to be a meaning to it.
He stopped believing in the structure of Yes's music.
Yeah, he just felt that it wasn't going to work, and a lot of people agree with that. And
was he gone after Typographic?
Yeah. And
how did you feel about that?
I was sort of beaten up because
in terms of musicianship, you could never find anybody who was his equal again. He's one of the greatest keyboardists in history.
Ridiculous. Yeah. You know, you go through that feeling like I made the wrong move. I went down the wrong road. I should have thought, because all the time we were doing Close to the Edge, why are you doing Close to the Edge? Why don't you do another roundabout? What's the matter with you?
Yeah.
You want to make, we can make so much money now.
Yeah, come on.
Just want another one. I said, no, I'm not interested.
Why don't you do
that?
I want to hold your hand.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Do your version of that. Do a spiritual version of that.
They wanted me to sing For the Night Has a Thousand Eyes. Remember that one? For the Night Has a Thousand Eyes and a Thousand Eyes. Bobby V. I said, you want me to do that? Please don't tell me.
Now, when was Yes songs recorded in between which?
I think it was just after Fragile.
I think you did. It's Fragile, Close to the Edge. Yes songs, Typographic.
You got it. But the idea is that everybody, Steve and Alan and Chris put so much into Typographic, and it was magic to perform and to hold an audience for 20 minutes. You can hear a pin drop every it's amazing.
How were the audiences when you performed that live?
It was amazing because our encore was Close to the Edge. So it was like we were living this new world of music, which is kind of crazy thinking, but I felt we'd found this big cloud that we could sail around the world on, and we were playing this music that was, and then as time went along, you realized that one part of the puzzle, Rick, he wasn't enjoying it, and it sounded like he wasn't enjoying it, and he was caught once with, some Indian food underneath his keyboard. We were doing a show, and he had some Indian curry underneath his keyboard.
Oh, my God.
So that broke the back.
But help me with this, because the thing I've learned from people who are these immensely successful, and people are just eating your music up alive, they love it. Mm. It's so fresh and so new and so brilliant, and you guys are going along, and then one cylinder in the engine decides to pop out.
Yeah.
What are the other guys, how do they feel?
Well, we have got to get a new keyboard player. Where's a new keyboard player? That was the first, I thought, silliest story ever. I started thinking, and I just heard about this guy called Vangelis Papathanassou, who lived in Paris. And I'd seen a photograph of him using laser beams. So we got laser beams. And I went to meet Vangelis. And I loved his first album. It was called Creation du Monde. I used to play it before a Yes show. So when audiences are coming in, they're hearing this cosmic music by Vangelis, So I won't tell you the story, meeting him and everything, but he nearly joined the band. I invited him to London to join the band as soon as Rick went.
Well, why don't you want to tell the story of meeting him? Why?
Well, it's silly. It's like...
well, tell it.
Okay, so I get to Paris. I find his phone number. I've got his number. I call him up. Hello?
Hello.
Vangelis?
Yes.
Oh, my name's John Anderson. I sing in a band called Yes.
What's Yes? I don't know Yes.
It's a band, A band, I'm a singer. Oh, John, Johnny, come over. So I went over to his apartment, right? And I opened the door and he's standing there, tall guy with a long sort of kaftan, big beard and everything. And he has a big bow and arrow over his shoulder, like a long bow, Hey, Johnny, come give me a hug, So...
So he's in the middle of an archery session.
Yes, and he said he had a very long hallway. All the way down the bottom of the hallway was a target.
He's shooting.
And he said, watch this, John. and he takes a bow and arrow, zoom, and it went right through the window.
And hit the postman.
Hey, I just laughed because it was just so beautiful. And I went around his house with cassettes everywhere. Oh, listen to this. I have this music. Listen to this. And then he started playing with these big fat fingers, the most gorgeous music I'd ever heard.
When you said he almost joined the band, what was that about?
Well, I asked him to come over to England and join the band. And Steve and Chris thought I was crazy. Who is this guy? You know, I said, let's try it.
He's going to shoot arrows at us. Bloody so, crazy.
Yeah, I know. So we started rehearsing and Steve's got his guitar tuning up and absentmindedly Vangelis says, hey, you know, electric guitar, not a real instrument, you know. Because so, he was one of those crazy Greek people. I said, we're trying to make friends here, Vangelis.
You know, trying to fit in.
It didn't
buddy.
Work, so.
He was gone.
And then I became friends with Vangelis, of course.
How do you find your next keyboardist? Where?
So Patrick Meraz came along to my house and started playing the piano. He was brilliant. He was in London. He's from Switzerland.
Was he in another band?
He was in a band called Refugee. But he wanted to join the band, and as soon as he played the piano, I said, you're good. You're very good. And I was overjoyed that we'd found somebody equally as exciting and possibly talented as Rick. So we started rehearsing, and we did the Relayer album. One song we did was called Gates of Delirium, which is a long-form piece of music. And it was the first one that I actually... Strangely enough, I've been playing the piano a lot. I took to the band, me playing it. And I went through it. I'd learned four parts, you know. And I can't believe that they understood me because that was terrible. That was terrible.
So Meraz did that album, Relayer.
Yeah, he did Relayer. Chris was on top of that. Gates of Delirium was fantastic to perform. It was like this wild, warlike tendency. Why humans or why we're all into war? And
now, when you say the House of Cards falls, what happens after Relayer comes out? Are there more changes and does it start to blow apart?
It gets a bit strange because Patrick, bless him, starts to wander off and finds himself in Brazil and he got married and things like that. And we lost contact. And we decided...
Patrick Meraz.
We decided we wanted to start recording. And somebody said, well, why don't we record with the Queen? I've been recording in Montreal. They've got a studio there. It's lovely there in Switzerland. And we won't have to pay taxes that year and all that kind of crap. And so we all go to Switzerland and Montreal is beautiful. And, I'm there and... writing and dust was gathering on his keyboards. It was that kind of strange feeling. Where is he? And so we carried on rehearsing ideas and stuff. And, I bumped into Steve Howe at a Holiday Inn near Detroit about 4 months earlier. I'd gone past his room and the smoke coming out from under the door and he was playing this riff. Sort of thing. And I thought, that's kind of nice. And I said, hi, Steve. Hi, John. I went to have breakfast. I came back. He's still playing it. I said, why don't you change key? So I walked in and sang the main line of Awaken, which is the first verse or the kind of thing. And then I said, Steve, how many chords can you play without repeating? And he started playing all these chords. I said, keep playing them and repeat from da 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 da. Workings of man set to ply out historical life, rear again in the flower of the fruit of his tree. And he just popped out. And I was actually in that space of saying, let's just do that. That'll be the second stanza. And then there'll be another stanza. And then I'm going to do a harp thing. And Steve said, why? Because I'm playing the harp every day. I'm on tour, which I did, you know. But that was great, making that album. And Awaken is so beautiful to create and perform. And we'd still perform it just now.
What's music in your life that's not your music? Do you listen to a lot of music?
Sibelius. I know, it's terrible.
No. What's your favorite?
I just listened to the Seventh 3 times yesterday before I came here. I was driving around shopping.
I love the Fourth for some reason.
Oh, God, yeah.
I love the real sonorous and moody and dark.
Well,
yeah,
the Russians were on top of them.
Yeah.
He was pissed, you know.
So classical is big in your life?
Well, I think, yeah.
Jazz?
I was very big into Rassomon Kirk. I thought he was just amazing.
What about contemporary music now?
Well, there's always a great song here and there. Every week another song pops. Oh, my God, yeah. And there's a lot of great music out there that most people are not going to hear on radio anyway. So the only way you can do it and hear music is go to like somebody sent me a link and it was this band doing an Ed Sheeran song using pipes and things on a table. And it was the most glorious work of art, these people singing his song, but doing these kind of spoons and singing it in beautiful harmony. And they're a very famous band, actually. 5 million people watch that.
There are people, I mean, I hope this comes out the right way. There are people who write music. I'm not saying this with any judgment of them. And the music is pretty simple. I mean, it's rock music and it's exciting.
Yeah.
And it's I love you and you don't love me and why don't you love me?
Yeah.
And your music is very nuggety and very dense and very rich. And I'm assuming that the making of that music would probably set you up for even a worse case of what people suffer in terms of their personal lives. And did you find that the music that you were writing and the work you were doing was so intense that it negatively impacted your personal life?
No.
And what didn't?
I don't know.
You weren't married to your music?
Totally.
Right. So you were polygamous. You were married to your wife and your music.
Totally.
Okay.
And now my second wife, Jane, we've been together 25 years, right. And it's amazing. She is unbelievable.
You didn't find that to be a challenge to balance your home life and your work life?
It was obviously, you know, you're growing up and you're getting older and you're trusting accountants to take care of your finances and things like that. And they keep saying, you've got to buy more stuff. You've got to buy more stuff because there's so much money and you've got to buy more stuff. And you think, why? What, you know, I'm not interested in stuff, to be honest.
Right.
I don't come from that. I come from a very
simple
background from Accrington. I used to be the ball boy for Accrington Stanley, one of the first teams in the first league that ever was. Soccer, football. Mm-hmm. You know, my core values are very, very simple, very clear, that I can't believe I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm so grateful to be here speaking with you because I've seen you work and I know you're fucking great.
Okay.
And it's just the idea that I can't wait until tomorrow because I know the great music is coming. I know some great stuff is happening.
When you perform now, do you need to adjust the key in the way you sing?
Yeah.
You do.
Down a tone or half a tone.
You're down half a tone.
Hey, you know, I listen to my stuff. I was singing on helium half of it.
No. But it's so...
I didn't realize.
It's incredible. When you look back on the amazing, amazing work you did and the amazing music you made. And
I thank
so
you.
Much for,
I thank you.
But when you look back, was there anything you would have done differently?
No.
No.
I can't believe where I am now. You know, we're just going to go into the Hall of Fame. Well, when people
was that
hear,
something that you wanted? Does that mean something to you?
No. It was something to do with this manager 20 years ago who said, I'm going to get you in the Hall of Fame. I said, I don't care. It'll happen when it happens.
Right.
And that's my mantra. Things will happen when they happen. Don't tell me I'm going to be in the Hall of Fame. All my heroes are there.
there's nothing you would do differently?
I can't, no. I can't think.
It's hard to think about that.
There's obviously things I should have done differently.
In an interview last August with Classic Rock, Anderson said, quote, for me, Yes was about the adventure of music, not making a living. The adventure itself will create great things, unquote. Indeed, it has. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.